Hello there, welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is sponsored and brought to you by Bikesure as the UK's largest independent bike insurance broker. They will bring you the exact quote you need for your bike, moped or scooter insurance.
Don't forget to please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from so that you never miss an episode, or you can watch the whole show right here on YouTube.
Right, every week we have an absolutely amazing guest, and today we have knocked it out of the park. This guy is an absolute legend on and off the track, a 2-times world superbike champion, a world-class musician, singer, songwriter, presenter, commentator, all-round good egg, and a handsome bastard. Don't you hate him sometimes? He is, of course, the amazing James Toseland. JT, thanks for coming on, mate.
My pleasure, my friend. How are you doing, lads? All right?
We're good.
You know how animated Ewan gets, James. I mean, that is one of the most energetic intros we've ever had, I think. You're absolutely blessed, my friend.
I feel very, very privileged. It's been a while since me and Ewan did something, and I'm sufficiently nervous, shall we say, as I'm staying.
he's only just recovered. I've not seen him for like 10 years. He's all right. Yeah.
It's that post Ewan Thomas experience where we all need to lie down in a darkened room. Yours has been 10 years long.
I tell you what, though, I've put a polar neck jumper on, and like now I've just started this. The nerves are just kicking in. I'm absolutely boiling. I'm sweating.
Typical Yorkshireman, you see, getting ready for terrible weather. We're always waiting for that come around.
Yeah, I still haven't put the heating on. You know what I'm like.
Whoa, no. That's at least January when that starts, mate.
Absolutely.
Right, let's get up to speed with the side of your career and what is the kind of collateral damage is probably the word of being in the motorsport industry like you've been in. Let's talk wrists initially, because I know you're coming off the back of another wrist operation. It's your 8th?
I've just unfortunately had to go for an emergency 9th.
Emergency 9th? Wow. Well, get up, because I mean, anyone that's listening to this that knows James Toseland knows exactly what your history is with this wrist injury. 9th surgery on it. What is it? What is the kind of latest on it? And, well, more importantly, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, guys. Thanks for asking. It has been a journey. 9 operations in 13 years. If anybody's had a recovery from one serious injury, it takes its toll. It really does. I crashed in Aragon in Spain, which ironically tomorrow morning I'm off to because that's the next round of the World Superbikes. So it always brings those kind of memories back. But yeah, about turn 8, turn 9, I crashed. Not the biggest crash I've ever had, but unfortunately did that really badly on the floor. And it dislocated my bones. They flipped the bones. And it was a really, really awkward injury because you've got 8 bones in your wrist, and the mechanics in here, what they do to be able to do that is just incredible. Your wrist joint is just incredible. And mine didn't. And the bone just slipped down and then couldn't fold over the other one. And it literally left me with 0 movement on my right wrist. And literally overnight at 29 years old, I was having to retire from what I love doing. And it was a shock, a real shock, because my initial diagnosis in Spain was a slight fracture. I'll be back on the bike in 2 weeks. I came back from Barcelona in excruciating pain. As a motorcycle racer, you can kind of put together the pain with what the injury, the extent of the injury, because you get used to it. And the pain level just didn't match up to a slight fracture. So I was a little bit worried about it. So I went to the surgeon in Manchester and I said, could you just check this out? He'd got a suit on. He was at a wedding. He actually came out of a wedding for me. He got a cravat on and everything, bless him. And he x-rayed the wrist, and he literally was taking his cravat off as he was looking at the x-ray. And he went, oh, dear, James, you've got a catastrophic injury here. We need to operate today, because in 24 hours, your hand could be paralyzed because the blood flow stopped. And he says, I'll do my best for you. I'll do my very best for you, but this is naughty, and you might lose your movement in your wrist.
What's through your mind there, where you were initially told, be back in a couple of weeks, by the next round, you should be back there where you need to be? And let's be honest, I know you mentally and physically. You're an absolute animal. You're a winner in life. You love competing. And then to be told, hang on, this is catastrophic. You may even lose the use of it altogether. I mean, how do you stay positive going into that surgery knowing, wow, I'm going to be put to sleep, and when I wake up, my life probably has changed forever?
Do you know what it's like, Ewan, when you get a real shocking kind of message? you go into kind of like just trying to find the positives in it. So initially I was doing stupid things like, well, I can't do that. I haven't brought my toothbrush. I've only come over for an exit. I can't say I'm brought enough stuff. I was literally sat next to my brother, and my brother looked at me and I looked at him because he took me over because I was in so much pain I couldn't drive. So we were sat together in this room and literally just heard that. And then the surgeon had to rush out to organize the theater. So we were sat in this meeting room, or pre-room for the op. And then my brother's like, oh, I'll go back and get some stuff then. We were in Manchester, and Sheffield's not, you know, it's not a pop, is it? You know, it's a good hour. And then my brother went out to go and get my stuff, and I then just sat on my own. And then it was daunting because it was a rush. It was like, you know, get your gear off, get into your gown. We need to get some anaesthetic in you, and we need to get this procedure. And like, I didn't have time to question it, have a second opinion. It was really, really stressful. But because I'd had many, many operations before with the motorcycle racing, I was just in that mode of, look, it's just another one. The warning's just a warning, as all the surgeons have to do, give you the worst case scenario. But I'll, you know, 6 weeks, I'll be back on a bike again. But unfortunately, his worry became a reality, and I lost. I had pins, 6 pins coming at my wrist like a guitar. They literally, they were external pins, just to keep the bones in the place that they should be. Uh-huh. And then when they removed them after 8 weeks, the bone just slipped, and that was it. And I tried to come back at Silverstone and at Nürburgring, my final race. I tried, was in Germany, and it was fixed. And I was opening the throttle like that, and I couldn't turn the throttle off. And I was riding around to Germany, and it was the hardest. Kind of, I crashed actually in the rain because I couldn't control the bike properly. And I crawled across the floor. And there's the, you know, in a sportsman's career, unfortunately, there's a moment where you've just got to make the decision that this is it. And when it's 10 years too early, you haven't considered it. You haven't even contemplated not doing that anymore. And as Ewan knows, when you wake up every morning and you are so focused and dedicated to your job and what you do, and you have a chance of being the best in the world, it is all consuming. And when you don't have that anymore, it's a big void. It's a massive void in your life to kind of fill again with other things to keep you focused.
James, with the benefit of the hindsight that we're talking about here, does the fact that you managed to get back on to see if it would work, did that help with any closure? I know it was terribly, terribly early, but you got yourself back on, which when I'm hearing it, you just think, Christ almighty, it would take so much for you to climb back on, but because it's your love, your life, and it's your vocation. But to know, however kind of that ended, that you got back on and thought, I've given it absolutely everything. It's pissing it down in Germany. You know what I mean? I just can't do it. Is there any little form of kind of solace in that? The fact that you got back on to know that that was categorically the only way that it could go?
Not then. No, because after Germany, I met up with the surgeon at Manchester at Heathrow Airport in the departures in the bar. And I met up with him in a desperate situation and a desperate state of asking him, look, there must be something. There must be something we can do to get this wrist moving. And unfortunately, we'd exhausted all options with it. And the at Heathrow Airport in that bar, he said, look, I'll get us a drink. And we both had a Guinness in the bar. And he bought me a drink and put the Guinness down. And I then knew with his body language and the way he was talking, unfortunately, James, this is as good as it's going to get. So that was after Nürburgring. So then because he was flying on somewhere, I can't remember where he was flying on to, I literally walked out to the car. The car was in the car park, and I sobbed for a long time. I sobbed, big time.
It's horrific. But in terms of making the most of a bad situation, you've gone on to do all right, mate. Let's be honest. I mean, your music is absolutely fantastic. I mean, I'm assuming the wrist is okay to play because you've got this tour coming up. Are you in an okay place now? You're hoping it's going to be good?
I had an operation in December in Austin, Texas, because on the sixth operation, I had it fused. because the pain and discomfort and all the false risks that all failed, I was getting into a really bad place with it because I was in chronic pain all the time. I didn't even brush my teeth for 2 years with it. It was on that level. And so I decided to fuse it. And then when it was fused, it gave me that respite of it not being that painful. But when I fused it, they fuse a wrist just slightly upwards like that because the plate is slightly angled upwards. And then to play the piano was really, really awkward. And I was not enjoying my playing. So I'd lost my racing with it. And now with a fused wrist, I was letting the piano go. So I'd been told about this surgeon in America quite some time ago, but I just didn't have the energy to like risk going to somebody new in America. If it went wrong, I've got to go back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't explore that option. But I kind of recovered for a year after I got it fused. And I just texted the American surgeon. I had his details from a friend. I said, hi, Alton, I've got a fused wrist. And all I want to know is, can you reverse a fused wrist? He went, yeah, absolutely. He says, come over to Austin and we'll have a go at it. I should be able to get you 50% movement back. So in December, I went there, got the operation done. And it was really successful. I got 50% movement back and it was great. Unfortunately, in 3 weeks, my bone developed so much calcification when it was healing that it closed the gap back because they had to cut the channel in it to get the joint back because it was completely locked. And it closed the gap back in 3 weeks. But before that, I'd booked the tour. I'd arranged to play the national anthem at Donington Park World Superbikes. And like all of a sudden, I'd gone from 50% to zero, zero in 3 weeks again. So 4 weeks ago, I was on a plane again to Austin, Texas to widen the gap, put double the amount of this cartridge that they put in inside it. And I planned it to do it now to be able to recover for this tour that starts on the 27th of October. And you might be able to see the swelling a little bit in the wrist. But I have this back and it was zero. So I've got... I'm off to Aragon this weekend, and on Tuesday, I'm in the studio recording the songs for the CD, for the sales, for the tour. And on the 27th of October, I will be behind a piano and I will be performing. But it is going to be an effort. But on my socials, I put in, that's why you thought he was eight, because on my socials, I recorded my journey in America, right?
Yes.
But I've not put anything on with this ninth because I was it was so upsetting to go through it again as a ninth because it is a bit of a toll. But fingers crossed, this one will work. I've got 50% movement back and I'll be able to keep it hopefully this time.
Is it good that you've got the focal point, the fact you have got the tools booked in, that you know now you're determined, you will do your rehab, you will get it sorted. And let's plug these tours if we can, because I know you're going to get there. 10 dates, you just said, you've got, I'm going to read it off, Manchester, London, Newcastle, Glasgow, Leeds, Sheffield, Cardiff, Southampton, where of course your VIP plus one's going to be me, Norwich and Nottingham. So you've got a lot of fans out there, James, who are paying money to come and watch you perform and watch the band and watch yourself. So you've got to be ready. You'll do it.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that, Ewan, because it is a lovely focus to have. It is keeping me focused. I've got behind the piano again 2 days ago for the very first time. It is rusty, but I'm going to be just playing until the tour, and I will be ready. I can feel that at this point in time, I will be ready. It's just me on the piano. It's acoustic set with Greg Haynes, who I do the commentary with on Eurosport Discovery for World Superbikes. He's going to be doing the hosting. It's going to be like this, just discussing where it all started from, how it began, and then when I wrote the two albums after I retired from racing. Those songs that I wrote were very much autobiographical about the life. And so this is the first time I'm going to be able to talk about what happened with how it all started with the racing, but then how the songs kind of integrate with that. So as we're talking about it, I'll be then playing a couple of songs during the event so people can understand it all.
It's got very strong Springsteen on Broadway vibes for me, that, James. It sounds amazing, that like the autobiographical nature of it plus the playing of the piano, and you mentioned playing the national anthem. I mean, we're not talking about some kind of grade two fella that's writing a couple of tunes. I mean, it's watching a master at work on the piano, my friend. Has that been a lifelong passion? Has it been something that's always been there from as far back as you can remember?
It is. I'm a musician first and a biker second, because I was born into a musical family. My grandmother, she played beautiful piano, and I lived with my grandparents when I was younger. So I was always around her playing, especially at Christmas time. It was that's what got me fascinated with piano playing, but music, because as a youngster, when all the family came around at Christmas to their house, and she got behind a piano, it created a festival. It created an ambience. And a joy for everybody, and she was the one that was able to kind of to give that to everybody inside the house, and just the attention on her, and just the to have that skill to be able to provide that for people. I was like, I want a bit of that. I want to be able to do that for people, and that's where it all started. And I was about grade six before I was introduced to bikes in my life. So I was very much, I'd gone past the crappy stage that you need to with an instrument, because that's, for you to enjoy it and for everybody else to enjoy it around you, you need to get past that. But luckily, I got past that as I got introduced to bikes. So when bikes got serious, I never wanted to let it go, because once you get to a certain level of an instrument, you're hooked, and you're very lucky to have it for the rest of your life. So I feel very, very lucky that I'd kind of got to that level of playing before bikes came. And yeah.
Was it your stepfather Ken that got you into the biking side of it? Was it that really lit the spark for the other passion, great passion of your life, which is motorbikes?
We never knew what a motorcycle was. I was at home with my gran, having my piano lessons every Monday after school, and everything was quite relaxed and quite calm. And then my mum went out for a few drinks one evening, and she brought back a biker in the house. And as you can imagine, my gran and granddad, grandpa,
Mortified.
they weren't that pleased with it. Especially then, all of a sudden, he bought me one for Christmas when I was about 8, 9 years old. And then I'm sat here talking to you guys as a double world champion. It's like, if you'd not gone out that night, I would have probably been playing at the Leadman in Sheffield every weekend, or on a
great
cruise ship
venue, by the
somewhere.
way.
So at what point did you know then, when Ken bought you that bike, you're 8 years old and your mum's probably saying, James, go steady out there tearing up the fields or whatever you're doing, at what stage did you know, hang on a minute, I love this music, but I've got another gift, I'm super talented on two wheels? When was that moment, that light bulb moment, when you thought, actually, this could be a career for me?
Do you know, more than the career, it was going back to school after Christmas, and how much attention and friendships I got through having a motorcycle, because we're from a mining village in Kiveton Park near Sheffield, and like they had the slag heaps just to go out back then. You could just roll the bike out of the house, go over there and razz around. So all of a sudden, there was like five, six, seven, eight of us all just going out, and I was like friend number one, because I'd got a motorbike, and everybody's able to just have a go on it. So it created friendships for me. It created me being in the cool gang all of a sudden, from being, walking around with my leather satchel to my piano lessons. You can imagine how mates I got for that. You know what I mean? So I'd gone from getting winded around the back of the bike chair, because I was behind it, to being like, the number one kid with a bike. And like, I'm kind of exaggerating things here, but it was a thing. It really established me, and gave me confidence. From doing something I was a little bit shy and embarrassed about, but I loved it and I wasn't going to give it up, to just being absolutely accepted. And then obviously, from trials riding to motocross, then onto road racing, that I started when I was 14 years old. When I started road racing, actually, as a discipline on a motorcycle, I then knew. I thought, oh, hang on a second, I love this and I'm good at this. So at 14 years old is the answer to knowing that I could be competitive.
I mean, that's that the jump from there to being, well, part of the elite club of British motorcycling greats. You mentioned it about where you stand with it and that, and rightly and proudly so. Can you single out a greatest influence on that type of rider that you became, of who pushed you to be world champion?
Oh, good question. One of my first heroes was Kevin Swantz from Texas. He was in Grand Prix racing in 500s. Just how elaborate he was with the wheelies, with the legs off the pegs, and how much he celebrated. And he was an underdog as well on the Suzuki at that time. And I think British people like an underdog, don't we? We always do.
Yes, right.
But I think I'd have to say Carl Fogarty in Superbikes, because in Grand Prix back then, it was mid to late 90s, there wasn't really a successful Grand Prix rider in the 500s. It would, you know, since the late 70s with Barry Sheen, that had been like the heyday, really. We'd been really successful in the 60s, 70s and 80s with Jeff Duke and Surtees and Mike Hailwood and then Barry Sheen, obviously. But it'd been a long time since we'd had a top British rider, and Foggy was that. And when Foggy crashed and injured himself and he had to retire in 2000, I had my very first year in 2001. And I remember, you know, going after that, it was big shoes to fill. I was only 20 at the time. But I remember thinking, well, if he can do it from Blackburn, and I'm from the north as well, why not? Let's have a go at it. So he was inspirational.
Did you get encouragement from people like Foggy when you were coming through? Obviously, he was in a dark place because he had to retire through injuries and that. But did you notice not only the British fans take you quite quickly, or did you notice fellow riders were saying, hang on, this kid's got something?
Carl Fogarty is so competitive. It was always a slightly uncomfortable kind of alpha male. Just remember who I am, James. when I'm in your presence. But Fogg is quite like that with any other rider, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying, because I say it with a bit utmost of respect for him, because without what Foggy had as his personality, he wouldn't be four times world champion. But unfortunately, as you know, Greg in sport, Greg, who's Greg? Ewan.
We tried to get Greg to do it, but he wouldn't do it at all. He was busy.
It's not a likable personality trait that you need to have as a true top competitor. You have got to truly believe that you are better than anybody else on that pitch, on that track, on that, you know, wherever you are doing your business. And it's not a likable personality to have. And some people hide it more, like Valentino Rossi, waving to the crowd, waving to the camera, looking so personable and likable. And he was a master at that. And that's why he was so much support. And some people can't switch off from, I want to kick your ass today. And I don't give a crap if I'm off your Christmas list.
James, does that mean that Rossi's secretly horrible? Is that what you're
alluding to? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. with a helmet on the racetrack, is all right. Dick. Because you have to be. Have to be. You know, because you can't not beat somebody at that level without being like that. And that's what sport's all about. And if you're not able to step up and go toe-to-toe with them, then go home.
How hard is it not to hold a grudge there? Let's just say someone, you know, has you off, you know, at one round, and then a couple of weeks later, you're having to almost shake hands, see him in the paddock and say, hey, how you doing? Have a good ride, or whatever. Or do you not? Do you remember it forever? And you keep it up your sleeve and you think, right, I'm going to get a dirty move on him when I get my chance. Or do you have to just wipe the slate clean after each round?
With motorcycle racing, it is dangerous. So you can be competitive, but you can't venture into being dangerous on the track. So the respect between you always has to be there when you share the same circuit. You can really, really, really dislike someone. But I tell you what, when it comes to motorcycle racing, even if someone does knock you off, very rarely have I ever seen anybody knock somebody off intentionally. That's a different game and that's a different argument. But as a professional at world level, you should never see, and I've never seen that happen. I've seen people kind of run people off the track, and then they've crashed with that manoeuvre, which is naughty, and you will be apprehended for that. Like we saw with the Valentino Rossi and Marquez moment, where Rossi pushed him out, and we all remember that kind of moment. There's an argument whether he intentionally tried to make him crash or just run him off and give him a message, but you have to stay clear of those kind of incidences on the racetrack, because it's 226 miles an hour now, guys. 226 miles an hour, and you don't want to be flirting with risking people's lives.
It's funny because it just makes me think of what I saw football wise this weekend with Erling Haaland throwing the ball at the back of an Arsenal player's head, and the outcry and uproar in that. And you're talking about going around at 220 miles an hour, and someone might nudge it. Because if you get nudged, then, I mean, that's literally life or death. someone bouncing the ball off the back of someone's head from about 4 yards away. Not quite.
Oh, no, it's relative with footballers, mate. It's relative with footballers. You know, you're looking to survive, you know, with a clip on the ankle, aren't you?
Well, yeah, because he always said, because they run around so fast now, so it must be really, really bad. But there's obviously plenty more to come, Jens, but so far chatting, it's been fascinating. I mean, in your 43 years on the planet, is there one thing that you can point your finger at that you're most proud of? Is there one thing that stands atop everything else, given your achievements?
Yeah, making my mum proud. Like, that is the biggest gift a son can give. When I came back to the area where I just won the championship, and she's uncontrollably bawling her eyes out. You know, you can take the trophy, you can take the money, you can take the car, you can take the girl. But seeing your mum proud is the biggest gift.
I think your mum would be proud whatever you do, mate. She loves you unconditionally. That's what mums do. But it must be very nice for her to go into the local supermarket or whenever at the time and have people say, oh, I saw your James at the weekend, didn't he? And, you know, she must have been bursting inside with joy and, you know, the tremendous satisfaction and pride you must have brought your whole family, not just your mum, but it must be a nice feeling. Because I know your career, we've talked about it, was cut short and that's cruel. It's brutal what happened to you. But you still have those moments, you know. You still had your moment in the sunshine, so you should always remember that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a real gift to be able to kind of give these emotions to people, and also the respect that I brought to the family through it all was a real gift. I think the biggest reward from life that you can achieve is to be respected. No matter what you've done or achieved or doing, you know, from a window cleaner to a world champion, it's like, if you can be respected as a person, it's the biggest challenge in life, because it's not easy to be respected, because you've constantly got to be your best yourself every day, because it only takes one or two days to lose it all. So you've constantly got to do that. But I was really proud to make my mum that proud, because I put her through the ringer, really, because from that one night out of meeting Ken that you mentioned, she did not want me to ride motorcycles at all. And then, you know, after I was 16 and turned professional, it was not the thing that she wanted me to do. So, you know, for 15, 20 years, she had to then put up with and cope with me doing something that she never really wanted me to start doing and also carry on doing. So to win the world championship was kind of my gift back to her on putting her through everything over the years with, you know, because I was injured a lot. We all are. The hospitalizations and the recoveries, it's only your mum that sees all that. Nobody outside sees all the hurt and the pain and recovery. So I felt like winning the world championship was just about even.
That's the perfect time. I'm getting a bit wobbly here, so I'm going to do a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping just to try and balance myself out. If you haven't already, please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from, so you never miss an episode like this wonderful one, or you can watch it all on YouTube. That is the most succinct and perfect answer about what you could be most proud about, James. That's really quite touched me, that. So, I mean, if then the question comes of how can you sum up motorcycling in 3 words, is that a tougher question?
Oh, 3 words. Fast. That's definitely one of them. I've done a lot of things in life, from jumping out of aeroplanes and other adrenaline-seeking events. But riding motorcycles at 220 miles an hour is the most fun you can have on this planet, in my biased opinion. Fun, fast. Is going to be 3 F's.
Keep it clean.
Flirtation.
Yeah.
Flirtation.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Fulfilling.
Fulfilling. Wicked. Super. So with that in mind then, JT, fulfilling probably most out of those 3 words, how do you now fulfill that need, that desire for adrenaline? I mean, obviously playing in front of crowds, seeing their faces, seeing them get enjoyment out of your music is amazing, but it must be very hard when you've gone from not just a sport, but a career you loved, which was thrill-seeking, it was dangerous. How do you then replace that? Is it jumping out of the aeroplanes and doing other things like you said?
Unfortunately, Ewan, it's age and time, because there is no replacing it. I had 6 operations on my wrist to get it moving, to get back to it, if I'm honest. Even though I'd retired officially, I then went on to another 7 or 8 years beyond that to get back what I'd lost, because I don't think humans can recover from anything of this nature, which is so devastating quickly. And you've just got to go through a certain process, and you can recover quicker or slower depending how you cope with it and what you do with your life during that period. And people kind of slip down the slippery slope of life, as we know, to replace things with alcohol and drugs and all the rest of it, which it can replace emotions of some levels, but it doesn't allow you to heal, and it certainly makes the emotions worse during that. So I quickly realized that, luckily, and now we've been 43, not 33, a few years after I'd retired, I'm old enough to not really want to go 200 miles an hour anymore. And after the operation in December, I got 50% movement back, and I did a feature at Donington Park for the World Superbike event that was going the week after. And I was able to just get back on a bike again and ride around the track for the first time in 13 years. And we did a bit of a feature on it. And I was riding around, and it made me realize why I found it so difficult in coping with life beyond it, because it is so much fun. Oh my God. Like, it is so much fun. But I realized it's like heroin to a drug addict riding motorcycles. And humans have to go through a process to wean yourself off things that are addictive. And motorcycle racing for me was my heroin, and I found it very, very difficult to get off it. And it was only when I had that shot again at Donington Park that I actually finished that day. And I didn't really want to go that fast. I didn't really want to risk myself that much anymore. And I just was left with an appreciation of just how fun it was and how fond the memories were. And also, because I was quite a bit slow, as you can imagine, after 13 years in the road.
Not quite 220 miles an hour.
There was definitely no comeback, you know, on the cards after that, you know. And I was like, wow, from 2001 to 2011, I was a certain age racing against absolute legends of the sport. So I was very, very lucky to race against in a period where there was the Troy Bayliss's, the Max Biaggi's, the Colin Edwards, the Pier Francesco Chiellis, the Norrie Hagers. And I was the British guy against those guys. So I got so much credit and respect for competing and beating those guys in some instances. And to have been at the right time, in the right place, and just to be that good at something. I was a piano player from Sheffield. And I had a whole career at racing motorcycles. At Brands Hatch, there was 126,000 people there cheering your name. I was on the podium listening to my national anthem. And there is no better feeling than being on a podium listening to your national anthem, and you've done it for your country, and how patriotic that is. And at Donington, when I was riding around, rather than missing it and wanting it all back again, I was able to really just appreciate and how fortunate I was to even have it in the first place. And that was the switch for me of where I am sat right now. I'm okay about it all. But it's been a difficult, more difficult journey for me personally, because 9 operations on this wrist, this is what retired me. This is what stopped it all, this injury. So having operation and recovery, the pain of this was just reminded me of that day for 13 years. I wasn't able to forget it because of this. And that, I think that's been, this has been made me, my recovery more difficult. But like I say, that moment just helped.
James, do you think, this is very hypothetical, and it's years obviously down the line. The way that you talk about that, the passionate way that you talk about that, the way that you lose yourself in the words very articulately about how you felt about doing that, do you think you would have been able to walk away from it? We look at greats in their particular fields, whether it's footballers, whether it's boxers, maybe pertinently after what we've seen this weekend at Wembley, with when do you walk away? When is the right time to say, I've done brilliantly, it's time to go? Do you think, given how you feel about that, without being categorically told by medical experts and the fact that you were in so much intense pain, that you would have got to late 30s, mid 30s, 40 odd, and gone, do you know what? I've had enough. I can't do 220 on this anymore. I don't either have the will to do it, or that fearlessness, because we all get older, as you say, that goes, doesn't it? That sense of oof, the trepidation comes in. Would you have been able to walk away from it naturally?
I'm not sure. I would have liked the opportunity to have done that. I was lucky enough to have a conversation with two riders called Troy Bayliss and Max Biaggi, who were 41 when he was a world champion, Max Biaggi.
Yeah.
And Troy was 39, I think he was. And we were having a discussion. I was saying how difficult it is, but they were having a discussion how difficult it is at 42 years old of not having it. And I was listening to them thinking, oh, wow, actually, it doesn't matter when we retire. This is the same problem, whether you retire at 41 just because you're old, or you retire at 29 because you got injured, you've still got to go through this process. Then, because I'm always trying to think of the positives. So as I'm listening to them discuss it, and they were really, really seriously struggling with life. I know Troy Bayliss had to go back to Australia and still race in the national championship in Australia until he was 50 before he could let it go. Oh, and he was still competitive because of his talents. But I was then going, hang on a second. Because I was 29, I was able to still be young, youthful, to try and be hungry to develop something else in my life. Yeah. Like with my music, I went straight to my music and started recording songs. And with the television, doing the pundit work and the commentary and stuff like that, where I thought if I was 41 retired and then 45, 50 by the time I've recovered from that mentally, because when you're recovering from things mentally and you're depressed and you're in a really, really bad place, you don't create anything for yourself. Mm-hmm. You isolate yourself. You don't want to be exposed to anybody. And it's a human nature thing.
You want to hide.
Yeah. So, and by the time you get to 50 and you're recovered, starting something when you're 50 is a completely different thing when you're 30.
Easy, so, easy now, JT. Do you know what? I'm actually loving talking to you. You genuinely, I know you really well, and you sound like you're in a great place. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it. It doesn't matter if you're 40 when you retire, you're 29 because of injuries. You've got to go for that grieving process because you've lost something you love. And like you said, at least you are young enough to have still that drive, that ambition, that desire, because you're a long time retired, to go back to your original love, which is music. And as I said earlier, you're thriving doing that. So you've almost, I'm not saying things happen for a reason, because no one wants to go through so many surgeries and pain and to have their career cut short because of that. But you've kind of had another bite of the cherry. You know, you've had two successful careers and you're still a young man.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I kind of went like that and then stopped at 29. But and then hit a certain point. But then I was too young to just do nothing or to settle down at that point. So I had to then push back up again at the same pace. Whereas Troy Bayliss and Max Biaggi, for example, they'd kind of gone like that in their careers because they were slowing down as they were 40. And then by the time they're 50 and 60, kind of like their mentality and their approach to life is, okay, now I have to kind of just start to wean. You know, to slow things down, where I was too young to not do something again at a really high level, and I was young enough to be able to do something at a really high level. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been staggering to listen to. I was going to ask you a question whether you take headlining at Glastonbury over a final race on a superbike, but the way you've spoken about all of those things, mate, I think you've kind of neatly summed it up, the closure that you got getting back on it, the ability to go again with this second career that's been such a long time in its gestation period. The tour sounds absolutely amazing, and I'm sure Ewan's looking forward to making sure he can get as many freebies as he possibly can in Southampton.
I'm definitely coming there, yeah.
But as we know, musicians, you make your money touring nowadays, so don't be tight, Ewan. Buy your own ticket, mate. Right. I'll make sure he does, James. Final question from us, because this is what we ask at the end of every podcast, is it's the ability to give us your perfect fantasy ride. So we want to know where you'd be going, who you'd be going with, what you're riding, because we've talked about motorcycling. We've not really zeroed in on actual bikes, have we? And of course, what the soundtrack would be. I mean, you tick so many boxes to be able to answer this perfectly that it's all yours, mate. Take it away.
You know, I'm in all my years of doing the interviews from the racing, I've never been asked that question once, and it's
Ewan's
good one.
Question. I'll give him kudos.
It's normally my question, but yeah, props have stolen it.
it's a good one. It's a really good one. Unfortunately, you talked about Ken. I'm a victim of suicide, unfortunately. He took his life when I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And he was never around for anything that he started and created. So just thinking about it, I would like to just ride to Skegness, where when I was 9, 10 years old, he took me on the back of his bike when my mum first met him. And on the back of his bike, I instantly started my passion for this crazy world of riding motorcycles on the back of his RGV 250. And I would like to ride from my house to Skegness. Maybe not on the back again, because it was a bit quick, but I'm a bit too old to go on the back. But on a separate bike, I'd go to Skegness and have some fish and chips with Ken and sit down with him and just talk to Agustin that he started, and I will be able to achieve from it.
That's as good an answer, I think, as we've heard you. And I mean, you can dress it up in kind of Hollywood cinematic glory, but getting over to Skeggy, see a bit of the sea and have some fish and chips with someone that you love, my word, mate, there's nothing better than that, is there?
That's real. I think that's the realest answer we've had. Mm. I don't care about Route 66 on a bobber, or, you know, what you've said there is so personal to you. And I think everyone who's watching and listening to this pod will have their own thoughts of who their dream companion would be, music and bike. And yeah, what a lovely chat, JT. Honestly, we absolutely loved having you on. It's been personally really nice for me, because genuinely it's lovely to see you sounding and looking so healthy and happy. And I'm pleased you're in a good place, and I can't wait to come and watch you on tour. We wish you all the best with that. And if people want to come and check out the dates, is toadlandmusic.com. That's where everything's on the website, isn't it? So I, for one, will be going down there with some mates. And yeah, just want to say thanks for coming on. It's been a pleasure, isn't it, Pratt? It's been great.
It's been wonderful. It has been wonderful. You've been more than generous with your time, James. Let me just remind people about what Full Chat is, and of course, what it's powered by. Bikeshop, the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshop, they will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance, and much, much more. As Ewan quite rightly says, toadlandmusic.com is where you can get your tickets and your information for that. And this podcast is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcast from, or you can watch it on YouTube, as I'm sure if you've watched this or listened to this, you'd have known that we've been in the presence of greatness, James Toadland. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure, lads. Cheers, lads. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, James. And thanks to everybody for watching. It's been an emotional one. He normally needs to sit down after talking to me, but I'm going to have a nice sit down and a relaxed and a thoughtful cup of tea. JT, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for watching, and we'll see you next time.